For a long time I sat comfortably in the rear of the flying saucer, observing the bustling of people in their unrestrained busy lives. An unprecedented spectacle of projection, with no deficiencies or interference of any kind. It was always fixed, clear and with a degree of sharpness never achieved by our most perfect television sets, even though we were traveling at an incredible speed. Having had enough of this contemplation, I asked them to switch it off and went back to my initial seat in the hope of giving free rein to my curiosity by asking questions. So I began, "Is your world different from mine?" "Not much," replied the man who had remained inside the spaceship. He continued, "We also have houses, streets and trees, but our way of life is more objective. We don't waste time on futility and we don't worry about what is ephemeral and superfluous." "So you lead a perfect life?" he replied. "Not perfect. We humans can't achieve perfection. The word perfection doesn't express the truth, because nothing is perfect when imagined or manipulated by man." "And when should we classify an object as perfect?" I asked, intrigued. "Then we would say, this object fully meets the demands of the moment." In an effort to satisfy my curiosity, I tried to change the subject and asked, "Other entertainments in your world?" "Yes, there are lots of entertainments," was the answer. "And which do you enjoy the most?" "What pleases us the most and gives us great satisfaction is the act of doing good and helping our neighbor." "So you have fun helping your neighbor?" "Exactly. That's what fills our hearts with joy," my interlocutor reaffirmed with emphasis. "How can you explain the fact that we still have not yet reached the moon, while you travel from one planet to another with the greatest of ease? Your question includes knowledge you Earthlings are currently ignorant of. You don't know the planet itself, how can you claim to know other celestial bodies? Knowing other planets is to say, to maintain cultural exchange with each other, yet this exchange isn't even satisfactorily disseminated among the landowners themselves." He went on to say, "It is essential, first to civilize the nomadic and savage tribes. Civilize the many, many civilized people scattered across the earth, veritable human plagues polluting a civilization. Finally, it is necessary to know and follow the wise teachings of nature itself in order to begin studies on excursions to other planets. Unfortunately, the people of Earth live within a dead realism. So, will we be able to have devices for interplanetary travel?" "Absolutely, nature does not restrict anything. Absolutely nothing, it just offers obstacles. These obstacles can be overcome and when they are overcome they push us towards new sciences and, as a result, we acquire new conceptions of life. Obstacles are therefore beneficial and instructive." "Are you happy in your world?" I asked, eager for further clarification. "Yes, very happy," was the reply, "but there is no happiness on Earth," I said at that point. "To err is human. It's easy to make mistakes, but what's difficult is to recognize your mistake and learn from that mistake. Earthly man does not recognize his mistakes, and therefore receives and suffers the consequences of his own faults, most of which are deliberate." "I see that you speak frankly." "Undoubtedly, we use frankness, not only in our speech, but also in our actions. It is the same as using the truth, which is the eternal and portentous vehicle for enlightening humanity. Truth is a fountain of crystalline waters in which the well-being of humanity will eternally float." "That's what we are fighting for?" I asked. "To live is to fight, but for the irrational. For man and his fellow human beings, who already have a high level of reasoning power, life is no longer a struggle. If man is still fighting today, it's because he created this fight and doesn't want to remove it." "But how could we live without fighting?" I asked him. "It's easy," my interlocutor replied. And, in his desire to provide further explanations on the subject, he went on to say the following. "Let's take life, for example. Life on your planet is a whole divided into thousands of pieces. Each and every one of them is impregnated with charity, justice, kindness, understanding, judgment, humility, etc. Nevertheless, there are pieces impregnated with malice, hatred, rebellion, envy, destruction, as well as those imbued with the feelings of domination, perversity, wealth, etc. At present, all these pieces are completely dispersed and mixed up in the maelstrom of life, with the predominant ones catering more to their. That is, those steeped in destruction, domination, wealth, selfishness and others. Continuing, he said, if the leaders of life in their respective places, forming a single life, that is uniting them, then you would see that the good ones would be based in the inner center of life and the pieces impregnated with evil would be located on the periphery, in other words, the margin of life. Later, with great astonishment they would realize that the pieces that had been conveniently the so-called living is fighting, which has already become the fight, which has now become a popular saying. The case itself poses a simple problem requiring the pieces of life in their proper places, so that the transmutation takes place slowly and terrestrial humanity begins to live in its room or El Dorado. And how could we put these pieces of life to put them in their proper places? This goes far beyond man's current possibilities, as he is immersed in his immediate interests, which causes feelings of inferior expression to their moral evolution. He went on to tell me more or less the following: initially, the desired change would be based on the installation of countless schools free of charge and compulsory for everyone between the ages of 6 and 20. The inordinate effort spent on maintaining superb armies should be applied to spreading education among the peoples. Its practice, with the characteristic of entertainment, combined with sporting exercises, preferably in the open air and with a healthy diet, should be spontaneous. Properly dosed teaching, before reaching purely scientific levels, would be limited to life and its natural evolution, encompassing all the particles of the whole. Always emphasizing the balance and harmony of the constructive and intimate relationships between the visible and invisible physical. In this way, earthlings would compensate, in a way, for the harmful influences of the nucleus of their own planet, the center of cosmic and evolutionary radiation, which, due to its eccentric position, causes a series of endless disturbances. How? I asked, amazed. Yes, ice, melting ice, physical and magnetic storms, hurricanes, earthquakes and tsunamis, volcanic eruptions are all phenomena resulting from the deviation of the nucleus. On Earth, this core, which planets is located in the center, is displaced. Therefore, by taking its exact position, the planet will also lose its precession. Attentive to the explanation, the subject of which was for me a true revelation, I simply nodded my head in the affirmative. As he continued his dissertation, that creature who was instilling in me the first glimmers of true sympathy said, "Farming suffers too much because we don't receive adequate and sufficient elements for its robustness and vigor. These anemic plants provide insects with a habitat, a veritable paradise, because they are easily eaten away by their greed. The very strings of plants and flowers are dull and lifeless because the cosmic and evolutionary radiation center is out of position. As soon as the nucleus reaches its exact position, the radiations will be more dosed and equivalent. Then the plants, flowers and vegetables receive a protective substance from the radiation center, a kind of defense or immunization against insects, which will no longer be able to carry on feeding and breeding, and tend to be wiped off the face of the earth. From then on, the plants will have a more exuberant life, the fruit, the vegetables will be tastier and dozens of times more nutritious. Their colors will be more vivid and colors will shine in hues that will appear more beautiful to the human eye, giving them beneficial effects." I was completely engrossed in this explanation, when he added, "The plant kingdom, free from storms, frosts, and pests, receiving the radiation in proportion to its needs, will have its life prolonged and consequently, the crops will live for another 30 years or so, and their productivity should be maximized by 98%. At that time, earthly man will eat only 7% of the current amount of food he consumes. If today he eats 1,000 grams a day, he will be satisfied with only 70 grams a day. Surprised, I asked, what are we going to do with so much food? Not only will this fabulous amount of food be needed, but the planting of all available areas, including the current frozen zones of the planet, which by then will be transformed into fertile land. The very lakes and rivers will be transported to the current deserts in order to form useful seas of fresh drinkable water, will provide their share of utilization. In short, everything will contribute to feeding 16 billion inhabitants, which will be the maximum density of planet Earth. But for me, all this is inconceivable and fantastic, I exclaimed in amazement. How can we transport water from lakes and rivers to the deserts? Gradually, nature itself will take care of this, and the more evolved man of the time, with his collaboration factor, will take care of it. Intrigued by that astronomical figure of 16 billion, I dared to ask him, when the Earth reaches 16 billion inhabitants, which you claim is the maximum capacity, won't anyone else be born? Births will continue in equal proportion to deaths, but children will no longer be conceived criminally willy-nilly at any time. Then, the conception of a child will be controlled by pure love, and everything will be centered on noble sentiments framed in goals. Referring back to the beginning of your explanation, in which you mentioned immunization against insects, I tried to point out to my interlocutor that, here on Earth, we have always endeavored to combat pests of the plant kingdom in order to obtain better harvests. He pondered, yes, of course. But I think it's a difficult obstacle combating the pests of the field, because man can't even get rid of others that affect him more directly. What are you talking about? I said in an exasperated tone. My brother. This is a long-winded subject and it's not my place to address it. However, in order to satisfy you, I will say this: on a certain planet, the man who inhabits it, when he arrives at his home, a cave, a crevice or a grotto, encounters huge snakes, monstrous lizards and, on occasions, even gigantic lizards and, on certain occasions, even some gigantic Dinotherium, a genus of large extinct elephant-like animals. Earthly man, in turn, arrives at his dwelling, which is not a cave, often comes across mosquitoes, fleas, cockroaches and even, on occasion with a mouse. I mean by this that man, not even for his own well-being and comfort, in obedience to common hygiene rules, has deigned to combat this highly harmful beast, expelling it from his neighborhood for your health. So I ask you, are you going to eliminate pests that do you no immediate harm? Interrupting him, I said, but you can't compare a rat with a Dinotherium, which is much bigger than an elephant. That's where you're wrong, he replied. And to make himself more understandable, he went on, both on my planet and on Earth there are animals that differ not only in size and appearance, but are different in ferocity and strength, each of which brings its own characteristics. We need to consider that the Dinotherium needs to hunt man down in order to devour him, while the rat, at a distance of 20 meters, infects him with the poisonous bacteria it carries. The Anopheles, a tiny mosquito, injects him with the virus, rendering his life useless. A flea, that athletic little bug, with a single bite turns man into a syphilitic wretch. The cockroach, such a fearful insect and harmless looking too, when it comes into contact with bloody meats such as salami, sausages or chorizo, contaminates them with the fluid bacilli of cancer. These are diseases that decimate your humanity and bring atrocious suffering to people, claiming young and fruitful lives. These bacilli are in a fluidic state, miasmatic, they are thousands of times smaller than the microorganisms catalogued by man and impossible to localize with the most powerful microscopes. The relative progress of optics, whose vast field of experimentation, is far from providing the necessary capacity for this discovery, since, it still can't distinguish between viruses of greater proportions. It is, so to speak, the bacterium of the microbe itself that lodges in places with little or no ventilation or light. To fight them effectively, you would have to choose one of the following alternatives: A. To abstain from consuming blood meat. B. Banish rats, cockroaches, fleas, mosquitoes and the like. C. Wait, for hundreds of years, until the cosmic rays of evolution no longer allow these microorganisms to live on Earth. In fact, the first two measures are the most feasible and positive, because they would greatly minimize the suffering of earthly humanity. As for cosmic rays, these are imponderable forces emanating from nature itself, the divine life force, which human beings will never be able to evaluate, since they are conceived in a field that is indefinable to their evolutionary state. Enraptured by such a precious exposition, I dared to ask further, "But if cancer is caused by microbes, why isn't it contagious?" This is due to a circumstance peculiar to life. Microbes are as yet known act in wide space groups. They could come together, but they don't. They act in isolation. The opposite is true of fluidic microbes, which act differently, because they merge and establish a real microbial current. And if we could discover the cancer virus, would it be curable? Yes, of course. In this case, you would be eliminating not only the effect, but also the cause. Unfortunately, the eternal evil of earthly man is to always be patching things up, never carrying out comprehensive prophylaxis. Thinking back, I remember asking you, what would become of the immense faults in the rivers and lakes that were transported to the deserts? In the meantime, my interlocutor stood up and said, the mountains are about to adjust and nature will leave everything flat. Then, putting his hand on my shoulder, he asked me expressively, do you really want to know my world? Do you really want to visit it? The sudden change in the subject we were considering and his attitude astonished me. I thought about it for a moment and, with a certain shyness, ventured to say, nothing bad will happen to me, will it? As I promised you, I can tell you that you have nothing to fear. Smiling awkwardly, I thanked him, but he continued to stare at me and said, we're about to arrive and we'll be landing in a few minutes. I received this communication as a real shock. My fear stunned me in anticipation of in a few minutes, God knows how? - the possibly inhospitable environment of a whole world. That's when my interlocutor, with a look of acquiescence, added, you can see my world. As I looked at them in amazement, I saw their smiling faces and I confidently stood up, full of curiosity. Chapter 4. The Wonders of a World. Filled with trepidation, I headed for one of the series of viewing windows located on the inside of the craft. Standing on my tiptoes, I tried to scan the exterior, but the incalculable speed of the device meant that I couldn't discern any details of the unexpected panorama. Although my eyesight was normal, it not allowing me to scrutinize what I was seeing, or rather glimpsed. However, at a certain moment, I could see a city that loomed towards the spacecraft with the appearance of being propelled by incredible force. As my vision roamed its entire periphery, I realized, contrary to the shape of our cities, that it was oval. It seemed to me to be a circle that was drawn out in an impressive way with its many details. Suddenly, without feeling a thing, I noticed a huge drop in speed. The disparity in displacement was so noticeable that I thought the aircraft had stopped. We began to fly in a horizontal direction at reduced speed, cruising speed, at a height of around 100 meters. We were now gliding over the city, which appeared to me to be made entirely of glass, and I could see its houses perfectly, its houses interspersed with gardens, all symmetrical and uniform in size, with their glass domes. Its streets, symmetrically gardened, with an impeccable overall layout, stretched indefinitely into the depths of the city. What are those moving objects down there? I asked, distressed. There are cars. But they don't have wheels? I added. Correct. In fact, By the year 1980 or even earlier, cars on Earth will have no wheels and will drive horizontally at a height of 2 meters above the ground, landing vertically like a feather, and noise will be reduced by 80%. The science of your world needs little more than to take another step towards these improvements. These automobiles or auto-aircraft will have a collision avoidance device. Persevering at my post, I watched. Now that the craft was slowly moving, seeing the inhabitants walking along the wide pavements, watching them leave their homes. Looking further ahead, I came across an enormous dark spot and, unable to contain my curiosity, I asked, "What is that?" "That. That's some of my people waiting for us. They have gathered at the aerial experimentation field, especially to welcome you," my interlocutor replied calmly and slowly. "What can I do to please them?" He looked at me suggestively and smiled a sympathetic smile. "I'm sure they won't need you to give them necklaces, earrings or amulets. Give them your presence and your sincerity." I clearly understood the allusion and smiled. At that instant I realized that I had put myself in the same situation as aborigines brought from the jungles of Goiás to Rio de Janeiro. It was bound to be a sensation. A novelty for the people who, in crowds, longed to witness the arrival of the rare specimen, man. He would undoubtedly become the attraction of the moment, would satisfy the spontaneous curiosity of the people. Naturally, they wanted to get a closer look at what they already knew through their very powerful video screens. Within the natural logic of human vanity, my condition would have been less inferior if I had been well dressed, but the state I was in was disheartening. I was dressed in fishing trousers, which were very poor. With a shirt torn from top to bottom, down the back, with my sleeves rolled up, I was wearing old rubber shoes and was carrying that indispensable belt knife, a machete. In this ragged state, I was going to serve as a feast for the eyes of the huge crowd, that was all too apparent. Soon afterwards, I could make out the groups of people waving to the aircraft, which was low-airing slowly to touch down. As it did so, it landed gently on a platform half a meter high and the door opened immediately. Two of the crew members and I climbed down, in that inescapable contingency, trembling with anxiety. I thought I'll never be able to describe what happened to me. Then that person, my tireless guide, held out his hand and asked me to leave. I headed for the door and stopped when I saw the crowd surrounding the apparatus. Everyone, men, women and children of all ages, were there to welcome me and smile happily. About 5 meters apart, they waved in a fraternal way, their countenances were warm and welcoming, and they were happy to welcome us. At that moment, what struck me most, apart from the great mass of strange beings belonging to a strange world, was the complete absence of noise. Everything seemed to be surrounded by subtle and mysterious music. However, witnessing the movements of a mass of people who were giving vent to their feelings of joy, yet the silence there was absolute. Only music from above filled the atmosphere, the softness of which did not prevent silence. Supported by my companion, I went downstairs to receive the greetings and hugs of those who approached me. No doubt they had been warned in advance about the way the Earthlings greeted each other. They did so. They were imbued with the desire to please me, because they hugged me warmly, according to our earthly habits. Ceremoniously, I returned their greetings as best I could. My reception ceremony went on for a long time. After being greeted at length by those present, the crowd, I believe at a signal from my guide, moved away reverently and I was led by the arm among that human mass. They parted into two wings for us to pass between until we reached the street. Then my companion, looking at me once again, said in his visual language, "Look, look and observe, ask as many questions as you like so that you can later answer questions and so that you can report back to your compatriots when you return." Having made the recommendation that forced me to hold my attention in order to understand it, I eagerly turned round to contemplate the magnificent spectacle of that street. It would be difficult to describe the dazzling sight before my eyes. I was pathetically enraptured by that scenery that surpassed anything I could have imagined. We started walking at a slow pace and, at first, I realized that everything there was made of the same material. A glassy, relatively transparent material, modeled in every shape and form. It was impossible to understand how they managed to produce all that. What was the technique used to achieve such perfection, using the same material for so many different purposes? This was undoubtedly a real unknown to me. The street was, above all, an impressive work of architecture. Unlike ours, it was shaped like a tube of gigantic proportions, cut in half. It was approximately 180 meters wide, broadly concave, reaching 12 meters, according to my calculations, at its most central cavity. Its pavements were entirely smooth and clean, free of holes, cracks or grooves of any kind. The pavements were about 40 meters wide. The pavement resembled a huge sheet of plastic, impeccably laid out and never used, and was artistically landscaped. Its rounded curb was identified by a long tube that discreetly accompanied it along its entire length as far as the eye could see. I looked at the houses, invariably round, equidistantly arranged, interspersed with superb, carefully flowered gardens. They had no windows. I could only see their entrances that conformed to the shape of a semicircle. Everything there impressed me with its perfection, what majestic grandeur of the constructions and proportions, offering as a whole almost aerodynamic lines of immeasurable beauty. We continued along the street, in Factorial Avenue. We crossed paths with other inhabitants who, after looking at my guide, addressed me an expressive greeting of unspeakable satisfaction. At that point, I was able to establish a precise comparison of their physiques by observing them in detail as they walked ahead of us. I'll now give you an anatomical overview of their physique. Evidently, they had a head, torso and limbs in identical proportions to ours, but differed significantly in certain details because they lacked certain organs. In particular, The inhabitants of this unknown world are toothless. Their mouths are the same shape as ours, but with thick but beautiful lips. Their noses are tiny, somewhat flattened and slightly protruding, located a little closer to their lips. Their ears are very small, like those of a newborn baby, contrasted with a head slightly larger than ours. In keeping with the lines of their rounded faces, their heads are also pronouncedly oval. Interestingly, they have no hair or down of any kind, including eyebrows. The most beautiful thing about them are their eyes, which are very lively, clear and deeply expressive. Despite their exaggerated size, they are unrivaled in their beauty, and endowed with a peculiar attractiveness that has yet to be seen on Earth. The girl's eyes have a yellowish hue, in a tenuously light gray color. In short, although they don't have the eyelashes that so adorn human eyes, their gaze has a private beauty, exalts them and gives them an air of sympathy and superiority, holding our attention. Their bodies, well provided with flesh, show no signs of bones or ribs, nor any protrusion on the chest or back. I noticed the marked signs of muscle. They're agile. Strong legs are longer and rounder, their arms have the same characteristics. Their waists are barely noticeable and their buttocks, which are much less pronounced, no longer show the usual groove that closes off the body. Their hands are equipped with two fingers, each the width of two of ours, flattened, but long and rounded at the ends. Feet of the same proportions and shape, also with only two toes, each of which is twice as long as our big toe, all in keeping with the structure of their bodies. Later on, I observed that their toes had no phalanges, but were made up of a kind of very strong muscle with powerful tendons inside. I also saw that the shape and constitution of their fingers, it is easier for them to hold any object, no matter how irregular, with just one hand, whereas we humans need two. Their fingers conform and adjust almost anatomically to the shapes of objects, which we can't do under any circumstances, making it much easier for them to grasp anything. In this way, they undoubtedly have more firm grip with greater security to hold on to anything. They have no nipples or breasts, no sexual organs, no fingernails, their necks are normal in shape and size. Although the female does not possess the same characteristics as our women, it can be immediately distinguished from the opposite sex by its grace, the opposite sex by the gracefulness of its movements, the greater delicacy of their limbs and more harmonious contours than those of their males.